to Delaunay's taste. Still, it was another matter to know that Alcuin's were. Somehow I found the stairs and stumbled my way to my bedroom, and I am not too proud to admit that I shed a good many bitter tears before at last I slept, exhausted with weeping. In the morning I felt husk hollow, emptied by the force of my own emotions. It made it easier to bear, seeing the faint shadows beneath Alcuin's eyes, and the smile he had only worn once before, after his night with Mirette no Orcus. I almost wished I could hate him for it, but I knew too well what he felt for Delaunay. Too well, indeed. For Delaunay's part he took it quietly, but something in him had loosened. I cannot put it into words. It was the same thing I had seen in the countryside. Some part of himself which Delaunay held tightly at bay was given rein to breathe. It was in his voice, in every motion, in the way he was quicker to smile than to cock a cynical brow. I don't know what I would have done had there not been news from La Serenissima that day. Between boredom and despair, I was ready to test Delaunay's tolerance, and cared little enough if he sold my mark. It's funny how one can look back on a sorrow one thought one might well die of at the time, and know that one had not yet reckoned the tenth part of true grief. But that came later. Then I was merely miserable enough to be morbid with it. It was the Comte de Forcay, Gaspard Trevelyan, who brought the news. His friendship with Delaunay was stronger than ever since the trial, and he had weathered the ordeal with admirable dignity. The taint of treachery had not touched Forcay. The news he brought from the palace was mixed. Vital Bouvard had indeed been taken into custody by Prince Benedict, but he had been found hanged in his cell before a confession could be obtained, and rumour had it that the regular jailer had been replaced by a man who owed gambling debts to Dominic Stregazza. When that man was sought, his body was discovered floating in a canal. There was no question of his drowning. When they pulled him out, they found his throat had been cut. It seemed Prince Benedict was no fool. He sent for his son-in-law Dominic. But Barquier Lanvert, or perhaps his cousin, must have feared the slippery Stregazza would succeed in lying his way out of any wrongdoing, which, like as not, was true. At any rate, Dominic's party was assaulted en route by a group of masked riders. They were deadly archers, who fled uncaught, leaving behind four dead, one of whom was Dominic Stregazza. "There's a rumour," Gaspard said shrewdly, "that one of the survivors saw Arcadian trappings on one of the horses. Tassels on the bridle or some such thing. And it's said that the Duke Lanvert went a bit native during his posting to the Caliphate. Do you know aught of it, Anarfiel?" Delaunay shook his head. "Barquier Lanvert? You must be jesting, old friend." "Perhaps. Though I also heard that Benedict added a private postscript to his letter, begging Ganelon to bring in Lanvert for questioning." He shrugged. "He might press the matter, too, if it weren't for other concerns in La Serenissima. Some rumour of a new scaldy warlord. All the city-states of Cerdica Unitas are frantic to form military alliances of a sudden." "Truly," Delaunay frowned. I knew he was worried, having heard nothing from Gonzago de Escabares since he sent a polite thanks for the translation I had made him. "Does Benedict take it seriously?"
"Seriously enough. He sent word to Percy de Somerville, warning him to keep an ear cocked toward Cumlach. We're fortunate to have young Deglamore and his allies holding the line there."
"Indeed," Delaunay murmured. I knew by the sound of it that he held a measure of reserve.
"So there's no talk of Stregazza retribution?"
"Nothing immediate," Gaspard Trevelyan lowered his voice. "I will tell you privately, my friend. I do not think Benedict de la Courcelle will mourn the death of this son-in-law overly long. It is my belief that he would have drawn that one's fangs himself had he not been wary of venom. And wisely so, Delaunay did not elaborate on the comment. I knew what he meant by it, and I dare say Gaspard Trevelyan knew too, but turned the conversation to another matter. I waited out their visit, attending on it with more than half my mind elsewhere. It is the discipline of the night court that stays with me at such times, rather than Delaunay's training. A useful thing to be able to smile and paw with a graceful hand when one's heart is broken. When at last the Comte de Forcay had gone, I had a chance to confront Delaunay. "My lord," I said politely, "you said I might return to the service of Namar when the matter was resolved."
"Did I?"
He looked a little startled. It hadn't been uppermost in his mind, and I guessed he was a little short of sleep.
"Yes, I suppose I did. Well, and I am willing to abide by it, on the strength of this news, though you will go nowhere without the castellan, mind."
"Yes, my lord. Are there offers to entertain?"
"Some few," Delaunay said dryly. There had been many. "Had you somewhat in mind?"
I drew a breath and steadied myself to say it. "I have a debt to settle with Lord Childeric de Somme."
"De Somme?" Delaunay's russet brows arched. "He made an offer this week gone by, Phaedra, but I am minded to let his anger cool before he sees you. De Somme has served his purpose. We'll get no more of him, unless Barkeel's up to somewhat I cannot fathom. I doubt it, though. He's made his alliance and had his vengeance. He's clever enough to keep his head down for a time."
"Send me where you will, my lord," I said, and meant it. "But I am Nama's servant, too, and I owe a debt to Childeric de Somme for what I have done in her service."
"Well enough." Delaunay gave me a curious glance. "I'll not gainsay you in this. I'll have the other offers sent for your consideration, and sign the contract with de Somme."
He rose to stroke my hair, the curiosity in his gaze turning to concern.
"You're sure of this?"
"Yes, my lord," I whispered, and fled his touch before tears could choke me. Of that assignation, perhaps the least said the better. Suffice it to say that Dessant's anger had not cooled, and I was glad of it, for it suited my mood. Never before had I used my service to escape any woes that troubled me, but I did that day. There was no artistry in what passed between us. Given license by his rage and my contract, Dessant greeted me with a powerful blow across the face. It knocked me sprawling to the floor, and I tasted blood, the red haze of Kushiel's dart claiming me with blessed relief. I did all that he ordered, and more. When he bound me to the whipping cross, I felt the grain of its wood caress my skin like a lover. I cried out at the first stinging kiss of the flogger, shuddering with helpless pleasure, and Dessant cursed me and wielded the lash with fury until pain overwhelmed the pleasure, and I wept out of both, buffeted by pain, guilt, and rage, sorrow and betrayal, no longer knowing the nature of the release for which I pleaded. Dessant was tender when he was done. I hadn't expected that. "Never again, Phaedra," he whispered, holding me gently and sponging the blood from the morass of welts he'd laid across my back. "Promise me you'll never betray me like that again." "No, my lord," I promised, dizzy with agony and catharsis. In some distant part of my mind, I hoped Delaunay was right, and there was naught more to be obtained from Childeric de Somme. "Never again." He murmured something, I don't know what, and continued to tend to my wheels, squeezing the sponge. Warm water ran over my skin, and I felt good, languid with the aftermath of it all, and happy that the first of my patrons still wanted me. I loved him a bit for that. I could not help it. Had always loved my patrons at least a little bit. I never told Delaunay, though I think he guessed it. I cannot guess at my appearance as I entered Desson's receiving room. I stumbled a bit, I know, but it must have been worse than that alone, for Jocelyn's eyes widened in shock and he sprang to his feet.
"Name of Eloa," he breathed. "Phaedra."
It may have been pain or weakness, though I tend to think the sheer unexpectedness of hearing him say my name like that made my knees buckle. Either way, Jocelyn was at my side in two strides. Without ceremony, he scooped me into his arms and headed for the door.
"Jocelyn!" Irritation cleared my head. "Jocelyn, put me down! I can walk!"
He shook his head, stubborn as any of his brethren.
"Not while I attend you."
He nodded to Desson's liveried servant.
"Open the door."
I was glad as we emerged into the courtyard that we were at Desson's townhouse and not his quarters in the palace. There was no one to see save a startled stable boy as Jocelyn Varailles, in his castelline drab, carried me to Delaunay's coach, my sanglois cloak trailing over his ashen and steel arms. I tried to ignore the strength of those arms and the firmness of the chest against which they held me.
"Idiot," I hissed as he set me carefully within the coach. "This is what I do."
Jocelyn gave the homeward command to the coachman and got in opposite me, folding his arms and glaring.
"If this is your calling, would that I knew what sin I'd committed, but I should be ordered to witness it and stand idly by."
"I did not ask to have you here."
I winced as the coach lurched into motion, throwing me back against the seats.
"And you call me an idiot," Jocelyn muttered.
Chapter 32. Delaunay offered little comment on my condition afterward, save to say in his very driest tone that he was glad to see I was in one piece, and to bid me use the Yeshuite doctor's salve unstintingly, which I did. As I have said before, I have good healing flesh, and the marks of Childeric Desson's wrath soon faded from my skin. During the time of my convalescence from this assignation, for whether I ailed or no, it would not do to go to one patron with the tracks of another still on me, Delaunay held a small dinner gathering for a number of his friends. Telesis de Mornay was among them, and when she returned some days later, I assumed it was to visit Delaunay. But I was wrong. Instead, it seemed she had come to invite me to a performance by a troupe of players, staging a play written by a friend of hers. No one except Hyacinth had ever made me an invitation for the pleasure of my company, and I was thrilled by it. "May I go, my lord?" I asked Delaunay, not caring that he heard the note of pleading in my voice. He hesitated, frowning. "She will be safe with me, Anarfiel." Telesis gave the gentle smile that warmed her dark, luminous eyes. "I am the king's poet, and under Ganelon's own protection. No one would be fool enough to trifle with that." A faint twinge, as of an old wound, crossed Delaunay's face.
"You're right," he conceded.
"Very well, then. Only you," he added, pointing at me, "will behave yourself."
"Yes, my lord."
Forgetting I was still upset with him, I kissed his cheek and ran to get my cloak. I had seen players often enough in Knight's doorstep, and heard them declaim bits of this and that from the season's newest plays, but I had never, in truth, seen an actual performance. It was enthralling. The play was performed in the old Hellene style, with the players in gorgeous masks, and the verses were resonant with poetry. All in all, I enjoyed it most thoroughly. When it was over, I was fair glowing with the excitement of it all, and must have thanked Telesis a dozen times at least.
"I thought you would like it," she said, smiling. "Japheth's father was an adept of Eglantine House, ere he wed. 'Tis the first play written outside the Night Court to tell Narmer's story thusly. Would you like to meet him?"
I went with her to the players' quarters behind the stage. In contrast to the well-orchestrated performance, it was chaos in their dressing rooms. The masks were treated with care. Players are superstitious about such things, but garments and props were thrown hither and thither, and the sounds of players squabbling mingled with the triumphant rehashing of the night's performance.
I knew the playwright straight away, for he was the only one in sober garb. Spotting Telesis, he came toward her with arms outstretched and eyes aglow.
"My dear," he exclaimed, giving her the kiss of greeting. "What did you think?"
"It was wonderful," she smiled at him. "Japheth no Eglantine Varden, this is Fedra no Delaunay, who very much enjoyed your play."
"It is my pleasure."
Japheth kissed my hand like a courtier. He was young and handsome, with curly chestnut hair and brown eyes.
"Will you join us for a drink at the Mask and Lute?"
he asked, shifting his attention eagerly back to Telesis. "We were going to celebrate the triumph of our debut." Before she could answer, there was a stir at the door. One of the players gasped, and a hush fell over their quarters as a tall man in courteous finery entered. I knew him by his long, clever face and his habit of waving a perfumed kerchief under his nose. Lord Thierry Rual, the King's Minister of Culture. Japheth composed his features and bowed.
"My Lord Rual," he said carefully, "you honour us."
"Yes, of course."
The Minister of Culture waved his kerchief, sounding bored.
"Your play was not displeasing. You will perform it for His Majesty's pleasure 5 days hence. My Under-Secretary will see to your needs."
Another flourish of the kerchief.
"Good eve."
They held their breath until he had departed, then burst into cheers and hugs. Japheth grinned at Telesis.
"Now you must join us."
The Mask and Lute is a player's house, and only guild members and their guests are allowed. As the king's poet, of course, Telesis de Mornay would have been welcome at any time, but I would not have been admitted alone, and so was happy at the chance. I sat and sipped my wine, marvelling at how the players carried on like children with their quarrels and dramas when they held such power on stage. It reminded me of the bitter rivalries that went on behind the scenes among the adepts of Sirius House. Thus I paid little heed while Japheth and Telesis spoke of poesy, but when their talk turned to politics, it caught my Delaunay-trained ear.
"I heard a rumour," he said, lowering his voice. "One of my troop had it from the steward of the Privy Chamber, who is enamoured of her. It is said that the Duc d'Aiglemore met in secret with the king to bid for the Dauphine's hand. Is it true?"
Telesis shook her head. "I had not heard it, but I have no contacts in the Privy Chamber," she added with a smile.
"Well, indeed," Japheth made a face. "Who would, were it not for the merits such gossip may afford? But I bade her keep it silent for the nonce. I've no wish to jeopardize our chances of playing before the king."
"And you shall, splendidly." I held my tongue for all of 3 seconds, but could not resist. "What was the king's answer?" I asked, as innocently as I could.
"He declined, and would give no reason," Japheth shrugged, "as he has to every suitor."
"That is what I heard.
Mayhap d'Aiglemore thought he was owed a boon for bringing House Trevelyan to justice, and mayhap he is, but not this one."
With that he turned the talk to other matters. Though I was neither poet nor player, and could not follow all their talk, I am well enough read that I enjoyed it, and the whole of the evening most heartily. When Telesis' coach took me back to Delaunay's house, I thanked her again. She gave me her warm smile and took my hands.
"It gladdened me to cheer your spirits, Fedra," she said kindly. "I have known Anarfiel Delaunay a long time. If you have care in your heart for him, do not judge him too harshly for it. He has lost a great deal in his life, and not the least of it is his verses. Were it not for, well, for several things, he, and not I, might be the king's poet. Alcuin is good for him, though Delaunay himself may not know it. Allow him this small happiness."
"I will try, my lady," I promised, abashed by her goodness. She smiled again and bid me good night. If it had not been for what happened later, I might have taken no notice of the playwright's bit of news. Of a surety I told Delaunay, who heard it without surprise. He was only surprised, I thought, that it had taken Isidore d'Aiglemore this long to ask. What he thought of the king's response I do not know, save that it was no more than he expected. And with that, I would have put it out of my mind, save that a day later, an invitation arrived for Delaunay, bidding him to attend the royal staging of Japheth No Eglantine Varden's Passion of Nama. Being Delaunay, he made little of it. It was hardly the first time he had been invited to court, but I saw the invitation, and it bore the seal of House Courcelle. As matters fell out, I was contracted the very day of the performance to fulfil my promise to Lord Rogier Clavel, who had returned from Kebble Imarcard with the Duc Lanvert. I half looked forward to it, for it would be easy work, and I had hopes that his second patron gift would equal his first. He had offered to send his own coach, an offer Delaunay had declined, but he sent word to accept Clavel's conveyance after the invitation arrived. He gave me no reason for it, but I knew he had need of his team. It would not do to arrive sweated and on horseback for a royal audience. Jocelyn, of course, would accompany me. We had spoken little since my assignation with Childeric de Somme, though I knew he was no happier with his posting than before. Well, I thought, he should be glad enough of Rogier Clavel, then, whose desires were so simply met. So it was that Jocelyn cooled his heels in Lord Clavel's quarters, rather finer than the ones he'd had before, I noted, while we disported ourselves. I dare say Lord Clavel was well enough pleased, and if a good portion of my mind was elsewhere, he never noticed it. For my part, I could not help but think of Japheth's play being staged in the Palace Theatre, and Delaunay's mysterious invitation to attend it. Rogier Clavel favoured afternoon assignations, and I knew full well when the hour arrived for the performance to commence. It was early evening by then, and we had finished with our sport. I fanned him while he lay on soft cushions, the sheen of exertion drying on his skin. By the time he donned his robe and went to his coffer, I had an idea. "Thank you, my lord," I murmured, tying the generous purse to my girdle.
"You've kept your word and more."
He looked eagerly at me.
"So have I, Phaedra.
The king has awarded me an estate in Lagnas. Do you think your Lord Delaunay might allow me to see you again?" "Perhaps." I eyed him thoughtfully. "My Lord Clavel, tell me this. Is there another exit from your quarters?"
"There is the servant's route to the kitchens, of course."
He blinked at me. "Why do you ask?" I had thought about it and had an answer ready. "There is someone I must see who made an offer to Delaunay," I said, putting a hesitation in my voice that suggested it was a patron I dared not name. "He would take it amiss to have a Castlean brother on his doorstep, but they are rigorous in their service. Still, Delaunay bid me deliver word if I chanced to do it without the Castlean present."
"I could send word for you."
"No," I shook my head in alarm. "My lord, the servants of Nama are known for discretion. I pray you do not put mine to the test. But if you would send your coach to the West Wing and bid Brother Verai to meet me there, I, and perhaps others, would be indebted to you." Rogier Clavel mulled it over, and I could see him assessing the risks and possible gain.
The gain won out, and he nodded, his plump chin wavering. "Easily enough done. You'll put in a good word for me with Delaunay?"
"Of course." I swung my cloak about my shoulders and smiled, kissing his cheek. "I will do so gladly, my lord." I do not pretend to know the palace so well as those who live there, but I thought I knew it well enough to make my way to the King's Theatre in the West Wing. It is a vast and impressive construction, which even a provincial would be hard put to miss. Still, I was unfamiliar with the servants' passages, which were far narrower and more poorly lit than the main hallways, and managed to lose my way in them. At last I found an exit into the palace proper, and stumbled into an empty hall, blinking at the light. Around the corner, booted footsteps were approaching. Two men, I gauged by the sound, and moving swiftly. I heard their voices before I saw them.
"Carmille's sword!"
one of the voices exclaimed, livid with disgust.
"It's not so much to ask for the protection of the realm. You'd think the old fool owes me somewhat."
Mayhap he's right, Isidore. Do you really think the Glory Seekers would follow you after you betrayed Baudouin? The second voice asked diffidently. Anyway, they're not Carmeline.
They're 100 warriors trained to fight in the mountains. They'd have followed if I led, all but a handful, and we'd have soon been rid of them. Never mind. I'll recruit in the villages if I have to. Let Courcel see how he likes it when Darjeeling peasants start dying in his name. He'll give me the Glory Seekers.
Isidore d'Eglamour strode around the corner and halted, seeing me.
Hold, Villiers, he said, putting up a hand to his companion.
With no other course of action open to me, I gave a quick curtsy and continued forward, my head bowed, but d'Eglamour caught my arm and gave me a hard look.
Who are you, and where are you bound?
I am on Nama's business, my lord.
He took in my cloak and studied my eyes, and it was the latter he recognized.
So it would seem. I've seen you before, haven't I? You offered Baudouin de Trevelyan joie, the night of the Midwinter Fest.
He released my arm, which felt as if it still bore the impress of his fingers. His gaze glittered at me like ice over black rock.
Well, keep Nama's silence, and take care you don't bring me the same luck, little adept, for I am about Carmiel's business.
Yes, my lord, I curtsied again, truly frightened, and thankful for once that a peer of the realm had no cause to recognize me as de Launay's Anguissette. They continued onward, his companion, the Comte de Villiers, I guessed, casting one quick glance back at me, then they were gone. Had I not been lost, I might have been shaken enough to abandon my plan, but as it was, I'd no choice but to make my way to the West Wing. By the time I arrived, my nerves had settled, and curiosity had the uppermost. One thing, however, I had forgotten. This was the palace, and members of the King's Guard stood at every entrance to the theatre, standing firm with spears upright. Beyond their reach, I gazed into the darkened theatre and saw the players on stage, lit by an ingenious system of torches and lamps, but I couldn't make out faces in the audience. Still, I could see the royal box, and it was empty. Disappointed, I turned to make my way to the western doors exiting the palace. I was just in time to see de Launay emerging from the theatre, glancing at a note in his hand. If I went forward, he would see me. Thinking quickly, I took off my sangoir cloak and folded it over my arm, walking purposefully around toward the rear of the theatre. If its design was anything like the other, I could hide in the players' quarters, for I didn't like to think on de Launay's anger if he caught me at this. I'd sooner take my chances with Isidore d'Eglamour if it came to it. As luck would have it, I guessed aright, and found the first chamber of the players' dressing rooms to be open and untenanted, save for the now familiar heaped disarray of props and garments. Beyond the next door I could hear an urgent commotion, but it seemed this room was far enough from the stage to go unused during the performance. Indeed, the quarters were likely more generous than those to which they were accustomed. This one held a great bronze-framed mirror, taller than I was, which must have come dear. I paused to glance in it and compose my features, when the mirror began to swing open like a door on cunningly hidden hinges. Between de Launay in the hall and whatever lay beyond the mirror, my choices were few. If I hadn't been in the king's own palace, I'd have trusted Japheth No Eglantine Varden to hide me, but I dared not risk it here. I took the only refuge I could, crawling under a chair heavily draped with clothing. Reaching between the legs of the chair, I dragged a pasteboard shield in front of it. Cramped and confined, I prayed to Eloa that it was refuge enough to hide me. There was a gap between the edge of the shield and a trailing gown of tawdry fabric. I reached out to twitch the fabric to cover it, then stayed my hand and peered through it instead. The mirror swung outward, giving back a crazily angled reflection of the dressing room. I could see my own hiding place, nothing of my person visible in the gaudily cloth-hung shadow beneath the chair. A woman, tall and slender, slipped into the room. She wore a heavy cloak with a deep hood, rendering her features invisible, but I gauged her to be young by the way she moved as she closed the secret door behind her. Anarfiel de Launay entered the chamber. I nearly betrayed myself with a gasp and held my breath to contain it. De Launay gave the room a careful study, then inclined his head to the hooded woman.
"I am here in answer to this message," he said simply, holding it out.
"Yes."
The woman's voice was young, albeit muffled in the depths of her hood. She folded her hands in opposite sleeves, not taking the note from him.
"I am... My lady bids me ask you what news you have of a certain matter."
"A certain matter?" De Launay echoed. "How may I be sure of who you serve, my lady?"
From my hiding place I could discern that her hands were working within the sleeves of her robe. She extended one briefly and handed him something that gleamed. It was a gold ring, that much I saw. De Launay took it, and she withdrew her hand quickly. "Do you know this ring?" she asked.
De Launay gazed at it, turning it over and over. "Yes," he murmured.
My lady bids me ask, is it true that you have sworn an oath upon it?"
De Launay looked up at her, and the emotions writ on his face were too many and too complex to decipher. "Yes, Isandra," he said gently, "it is true."
She drew in her breath sharply, then raised her hands and pulled down her hood, and I saw the pale gold hair of Isandra de la Courcelle. "You knew," she said,
and I knew her voice too, now that it was no longer muffled.
"Tell me what news you have."
"There is none," de Launay shook his head. "I wait on word from Quintilius Rouse. I would have told Ganelon the minute it arrived."
"My grandfather." There was an edge in her voice, and the Dauphine moved restlessly, though I could tell her gaze stayed on de Launay. "My grandfather would use you and keep you from me. But I wanted to see for myself. I wanted to know if it was true."
"My lady," de Launay said, in that same gentle tone, "it is not safe for you to be here, nor for us to speak of this matter."
She laughed a trifle bitterly. "It is the best I could manage. I have the queen's quarters, you know, since my mother died. There was a queen once, some 100 years gone, who was enamoured of a player. Josephine de la Courcelle. She had this passage built."
She crossed to the mirror door and pressed the hidden catch to open it. I could see de Launay's brows rise a fraction.
"My lord de Launay, I am alone in this, with no friends to aid me, and no way of knowing who I can trust. If you honour your vow, will you not give me counsel?"
De Launay bowed, as he had not done when she'd drawn back her hood. Straightening, he returned the ring to her. "My lady, I am at your bidding," he said softly.
"Come with me, then."
She stepped behind the mirror, and I could see her no more. Without hesitation, de Launay followed. The mirror closed behind them, once more blending seamlessly into the wall. Cramped and uncomfortable, I remained crouching beneath the chair for some minutes, until I was certain they had gone. Then, pushing the pasteboard shield out of the way, I crawled out of my hiding place and glanced in the mirror to see if I looked as dumbstruck as I felt. I did. Taking a deep breath, I gathered my composure and steeled myself to find the western doors and deal with the next confrontation. This one came in the form of a very irate Castelline brother. I had seen Jocelyn white with rage. This time, waiting with Rogier Clavel's coach, he was apoplectic.
"I will not," he began in a tight voice, "have my vows compromised because you..."
"Jocelyn..." Weary with the exhaustion that prolonged tension can bring, I cut him off. "Is not your order vowed to protect the scions of Eloa?"
"You know it is," he said uncertainly, unable to guess my intent in asking.
I was beyond caring. "Then hold your tongue and ask me nothing, because what I have seen this day might endanger House Courcelle itself. And if you're fool enough to mention it to de Launay, he'll have both our heads for it." With that, I climbed into the coach, settling myself for the homeward journey. After a moment, Jocelyn gave the coachman the order and joined me. His glare was no less furious, but it held something new besides curiosity. Chapter 33. Delaunay returned sometime in the small hours of the night, and was quiet and pensive the next morning. I more than half thought Jocelyn would betray my disappearance to him, but I was wrong. He performed his exercises with a particularly single-minded focus, heedless of the cold air, the twin blades of his daggers weaving elaborate steel patterns. I stood bundled in my warmest garments and shivered on the terrace watching him. When he was done, he sheathed his blades and came to speak with me.
"Do you swear to me that what you ask in no way dishonors my vows?" he asked in a quiet voice.
All of that, and he wasn't even winded. I was hard put to catch my breath just standing in the cold. I nodded. "I swear it," I said, trying to keep my teeth from chattering.
"Then I will say nothing."
He raised his mail-backed hand, one finger extended.
"This once. If you will swear not to deceive me again while you're in my protection. Whatever I may think of it, I'd not keep you from honoring your pledge to Nama, Fedra. I'm pledged to Carsiel to protect and serve, and I ask only that you respect my vows as I do yours."
"I swear it," I repeated. I hugged myself against the cold. "Shall we go in now?" There was a blazing fire laid in the hearth in the library, which was always one of the warmest rooms in the house, so it was there that we gathered. There was no sign of Delaunay, but Alcuin was reading at the long table, tomes and scrolls strewn across its surface. He gave a brief smile as we entered. I sat down opposite him and peered at his research, seeing references in several different languages and by as many names to the Master of the Straits. "You think to solve the riddle of him?" I raised my eyebrows. Alcuin shrugged and grinned at me.
"Why not? No one else has."
"You mean Delaunay?" Jocelyn asked, surveying the shelves.
He took a volume out and pondered it, shaking his head.
"One thing's certain. This is a Sire Valise Lord's library. He's got everything in here but the lost book of Raziel."
"Can Delaunay actually read Yeshuite script?" "Probably," I said. "Do all Sire Valise treasure learning?"
"There was an old Aragonian philosopher who would cross the mountains every spring to visit our manor," Jocelyn said, putting the book back and smiling at the memory. "While the cherry trees were in blossom, he and my father would spend 7 days solid arguing whether or not man's destiny is irrevocable. Then he would turn around and go back to Aragonia. I wonder if they ever settled it."
"How long since you've been home?" Alcuin asked curiously. As if he'd been caught out at something, Jocelyn's formal manner returned.
"My home is where duty bids me."
"Oh, don't be such a damned Castellan," I grumbled. "So are we to take it you didn't succeed as a fellow countryman in prying any further information out of Delaunay?" Jocelyn paused, then shook his head.
"No," he admitted ruefully. "My eldest sister would know. She once charted every one of Shemhazai's lines, every house, major and minor, in Siovaal. She could tell you in 3 minutes whose line ends in a mystery."
He sat down and scratched absently beneath the buckles of his left vambrace.
11 years, he added softly, "since I've seen my family. We swear our vows at 20. I'm allowed a visit at 25, if the prefect gauges I've served well my first 5 years.
Alcuin whistled. "I told you it was a harsh service," I said to him. "And what about you? What can you add to the mystery of Anarfiel Delaunay these days?" I had tried to be mindful of Telesis de Mornay's advice, but that had pertained to Delaunay, not Alcuin, and the banked jealousy smouldered beneath my words. If I'd not had enough questions before, I had a score more after what I'd seen yesterday. What was Delaunay to House Courcelle that Ganelon would use him, and how? What did Isandre de la Courcelle want of him? And what was the certain matter she wished to discuss? What oath had he sworn, and upon whose ring? If Alcuin had no way of knowing what questions roiled around my mind, he knew well enough from whence my hostility came. But he merely sat and regarded me with his grave, dark eyes. "You do know," I said in sudden comprehension.
He told you.
My anger flared, and I shoved at the books nearest me. Damn you, Alcuin. We always, always promised we would share with the other what we learned.
That was before I knew.
Quietly he moved the most brittle of the scrolls out of my reach.
Fedra, I swear to you, I don't know the whole of it. Only what I need to aid him in this research. And I promised only not to tell you until your mark was made. You're new to it, aren't you?
Will you see? I asked him coldly. They were the words he had asked Delaunay. I saw him remember, and flush, the colour as visible as wine in an alabaster cup. He'd known I knew. He hadn't known I'd seen. But it wasn't in Alcuin to evade the truth, and blushing or no, there was no guile in his eyes as he held my gaze. You were the one who told him, Fedra. He might never have let it happen if you hadn't put it in his thoughts.
I know, I know.
My anger died, and I held my head in my hands and sighed. Jocelyn stared at us, blinking and perplexed. It was no easy thing to follow a quarrel between students of Anafiel de Launay's. I saw too well how you loved him, and for all his cleverness, de Launay was as simple as a pig-herder where you were concerned. He'd have let you starve your heart out in his shadow before he saw. But I didn't think it would hurt so much. Alcuin came over to sit beside me and put his arms about me.
I'm sorry, he murmured. Truly, I'm sorry.
From the corner of my eye, I saw Jocelyn rise silently and give his formal bow, withdrawing tactfully from the room. In that distant part of my mind that was ever calculating, I regretted that we had driven him away, the first time that he had relaxed a little in our presence. But Alcuin and I had been too long together in Delaunay's household not to have this conversation, and it had been long days in coming.
I know, I said to him. I laughed, and my breath caught in my throat, but I had no tears left for this. I wish there were a little unkindness in you, Alcuin, so I could hate you for it. But I suppose I'll have to settle for wishing you well, and hating you for what you won't tell me.
He laughed too at that, his breath warm at my ear. His white hair spilled over my shoulder, mingling with my own sable locks.
Well, I'd have done the same.
Yes, I said, you would. I stroked his hair where it lay against mine, then drew out two lengths and braided them together, dark and white intertwining. He kept his head next to mine and his arms about me, watching. Our lives, I said, bound together by Anafiel de Launay,
who, having entered the room, cleared his throat.
Alcuin, startled, jerked his head up. My hair, braided with his, tugged at my scalp and made me wince. I can't imagine how foolish we looked. Delaunay's mouth twitched with amusement, but he managed to keep a straight face.
"I thought you might like to know, Fedra," he said, working hard at keeping his voice solemn, "that Melisande Charizai has come to visit, and would like to make an offer of an assignation."
"Name of Elawa!"
I yanked at the braid, dragging Alcuin's head back down with a yelp, and began undoing it frantically.
"Why can't she send a courier, like normal people?"
"Because," Delaunay said, still amused, "she is an acquaintance of long standing, and likely, most of all, because she enjoys seeing you discomforted. Be thankful I bid her wait in the receiving room while I summoned you. Shall I say you'll join us presently?"
"Yes, my lord."
I got the braid unbound and endeavoured hurriedly to restore some semblance of order to my hair. Alcuin laughed. He ran his fingers through his hair once, and it fell glistening into its customary river of white silk. I glared at him, and wondered if I had time to change into a different gown. Delaunay shook his head and left us. In the end, I elected to appear as I was, in the warm woolen gown I'd worn to watch Jocelyn practice. It would merely have served Melisande Charizai's entertainment to suggest that I was unsettled enough to need to arm myself in my best attire. She had arrived unannounced. Well, then, I would receive her accordingly, even as Delaunay had. I could hear the laughter before I even entered the room. Whatever else they had been to each other, she and Delaunay made each other laugh. I prayed he wasn't describing the scene he'd witnessed, though it wasn't like Delaunay to be thoughtlessly cruel. He beckoned me into the room, and I obeyed.
"My lord, my lady?"
I kept my voice level, made a curtsy, and took a chair. Melisande shot me one amused glance that nearly undermined all of my composure.
"Fedra," she said, cocking her head thoughtfully, "I have made Anarfil an offer he deems acceptable. My lord the Duke Quinsel de Morban is visiting the city of Elowa for the midwinter festivities, and he is minded to host a masque. His is the sovereign duchy of Kushith, and I am minded to make somewhat of a statement on behalf of House Sharizai. A genuine Anguisset, I think, would be just the thing. Are you contracted for the longest night?"
The longest night. In the Night Court, no contracts were made for the longest night, but I was not of the Night Court any longer, nor ever had been in the service of Nama. My mouth grew dry, and I shook my head. "No, my lady," I answered her, not without difficulty, "I am not contracted."
"Well, then," her beautiful lips curved in a smile, "do you accept?"
As if there were some question of it, or I could summon the will to decline. I had been waiting for Melisande Sharizai to offer me an assignation since I was scarce more than a child. I would have laughed if I could have.
"Yes."
"Good," she said simply, then glanced at Jocelyn, who had arrived before me to stand at ease by the door in his cross fan-braced stance. "A long, dull vigil for you, I'm afraid, my young Carceline." His face was expressionless as he bowed, but his eyes blazed like a summer sky. I hadn't realized when they'd met at the palace that he quite despised her. I wondered if it was because she had mocked his vow of celibacy, or for somewhat else.
"I protect and serve," he said savagely.
Melisande arched her brows.
"Oh, you protect well enough. But I'd ask better service were you sworn to attend me, Carceline."
Delaunay coughed. I knew him well enough to know it hid a laugh. I didn't think Jocelyn did, but he was filled with enough ire at Melisande's teasing that it hardly mattered. Oddly enough, it cheered me to know that despite consorting with House Courcelle and Carceline prefects, Delaunay's sense of humour was undiminished. I liked Jocelyn a little better for keeping my secret and his brief moments of humanity, but he needed to unbend a bit further if he wanted to avoid making a fool of himself in Delaunay's service. Or of me, I thought glumly.
"The longest night, then,"
said Delaunay aloud, collecting himself enough to divert attention from poor Jocelyn and smooth the awkward moment. He grinned at Melisande.
"You don't do anything by halves, do you?"
"No,"
she smiled complacently back at him.
"You know I don't, Anarfiel."
"Hmm."
He sipped at a glass of cordial and eyed her thoughtfully.
"What's your game with Quinsel de Morban?"
Melisande laughed.
"Oh, that. As to that, it's nothing more than Cushaline politics. The Duchy of Morban holds the Pointe d'Ouest and reckons its sovereignty thusly. But the Sharizai are the oldest house in Kushith. Fedra's presence will remind him that we trace our line unbroken to Kushil, no more. I may wish a favour some day. It is good to remind one's duke that there is merit in boons granted to ancient houses."
"No more than that."
"No more than that for the Duke de Morban."
She toyed with her glass and smiled idly in my direction.
"My other reasons are my own."
Her smile went through me like a spear. I shuddered and knew not why. Chapter 34. When poets sing of the winter upon whose threshold we stood, they call it the bitterest winter. Indeed, so it was, and I pray never to know one more bitter. But as the days grew even shorter, we knew naught of what was to come. Betimes I have heard people bewail the fact that our destinies are shrouded in mystery. I think, though, that it is a blessing of sorts. Surely if we knew what bitterness fate held in store, we would shrink back in fear, and let the cup of life pass us by untasted. And mayhap there are those who would claim 'twere best were it so, but I cannot believe it. I am Dangeline to my core, and we are Elowa's chosen, descendants of his seed,
born to the soil where his long wandering ended, and he shed his blood for love of humankind. So I think, and betimes I believe it. I cannot do otherwise, though I think they would have laid long odds on my chances in Night's doorstep. I survived the bitterest winter, and I must believe, as survivors do, that there is reason in it. Were there not, the sorrow would be too much to bear. We are meant to taste of life, as blessed Elowa did, and drink the cup of it to the dregs, bitter and sweet alike. But these beliefs came later, and are the fruit of long thought. Then life was sweet, spiced only with apprehension, and tempered only by the gall of petty jealousy. In the days before the longest night, my coming assignation was much on my mind, and I fretted over the preparations, until Delaunay, exasperated, sent word to Melisande, who replied, by courier for once, that she would see to all that was needful for my attendance at the Duke de Morban's midwinter mask. I remembered the cloth of gold gown she had sent for my assignation with Baudouin de Trevelyan, and was comforted in part. In another part, I was no less uneasy in mind, for the fate of Prince Baudouin remained fresh in my memory. Delaunay, for his part, was amused by my worries, when he paid them heed, which was seldom. Whatever the game in which he was immersed, Melisande Charizai played no direct part in it by his reckoning, and there was naught he wished of my other patrons. The game, it seemed, had moved to another level, one to which I had no access. With snow in the mountain passes, there came the resumption of Scaldy raiding parties, and the allies of Cumlach began to ride once more under the Duke d'Eglamour's banner. This we heard, and in slow creeping whispers the name of Voldemar Selig surfaced in the salons of the city. A rumour still, nothing more, a name heard too oft to be ignored on the lips of fur-clad raiders who rushed Carmeline villages with axe and torch, sometimes escaping with loot of grain and stores, sometimes dying at the end of a d'Angeline sword. These stories Delaunay heard with interest, cataloguing them in a record he kept, and another story, too, from Percy de Somerville, of how the king had commanded him to send the Azalis fleet against the island of Alba. Ganelon de la Courcelle had not forgotten how the usurping Cruach, whose name it seemed was Melkon, and his mother had conspired to aid House Trevelyan in treason. As a reward for his loyalty, the king had deeded the duchy of Trevelyan to the Comte de Somerville, who gave it over to his son, Guillain, to rule in his name. And on the king's order, Guillain de Somerville had set the Azalis fleet to gain Alban shores. But the waves rose up four times higher than a man's head, and after several ships capsized, Guillain de Somerville gauged failure to be the better part of wisdom, and shouted orders for a retreat, staying behind on his flagship until the last man still afloat could be rescued. I am no fool. I marked at hearing it how Alcuin continued to pore over the most obscure of books and treatises for references to the Master of the Straits, sending word to libraries in Siobhal and even to the scholars of Aragonia and Tiberium for copies of materials. Maestro Gonzago de Escabares arrived one day with a pack mule full laden with fair copies of books and old parchments for Alcuin and whispers of a direr rumour. The city-states of Caedica Unitas had formed strong alliances, and the north wind bore rumour, they said, that Voldemar Selig looked to Terdange, a riper plum for the plucking, and one fair rife with dissension. I do not think then that we were quite so rotten ripe. Ganelon de la Courcelle held the throne, and no one challenged it. He had the support of Percy de Somerville, at command of the royal army, a powerful ally still in his brother, Prince Benedict, and the interest of the Duke Lanvert, who held the favour, distant but lucrative, of the Caliph of Kebel-i-Makard. But Ganelon was old and doddering, and de Somerville's hold on the Duchy of Trevelyan was tenuous, for the Azalis had loved their Prince Baudouin, and did not take kindly to having a scion of Anil rule them. Courageous or no, Guillain's compliance with the king's order was held by some to be folly, causing disquiet in Azal. most of Prince Benedict's attention was still devoted to La Serenissima, and where it was not, his new enmity with the Duke Lanvert undermined them both, for where one said yea, the other said nay, and neither would both support the king at once. And all the while, Isandre de la Courcelle remained a shadow in the wings, heir to a throne that looked increasingly unstable. There is a power in naming things. I do not doubt that the rumours from the Kedaki city-states weakened Terre d'Ange, and I knew it for certain when I learned from whence they came, though that was yet to come. But of a surety, the political unrest that had marked the realm all the days of my life drew ever more pointed as the longest night drew nigh. I do not pretend I saw it all at the time. These pieces of the great puzzle I put together later, when the pattern was clear to see. That I had the wherewithal to do even that much is a credit to Delaunay's teaching. I dare say if he'd known how matters would fall out, he'd have armed me with better knowledge. But at the time, I think he was glad enough to have me safely ignorant and out of harm's way. And I, of course, had my own concerns. In the past, Delaunay had always briefed me before an assignation, reminding me of the patron's connections and influences. With Melisande Chara's eye, he shrugged, turning his hands palm upward. "Melisande is Melisande," he said, "and anything you may learn of her game may be useful. But I think she is too chary, even with you, my dear, to let anything slip unwitting. Still learn what you may, and pay heed to the guest's conversation at the Duke de Morban's masque."
"I will, my lord," I promised.
He kissed me on my brow.
"Have a care, Phaedra, and may you have joy on the longest night. It is the time for it, after all, and even Cushelines rejoice to see the Sun Prince woo the Winter Queen into losing her grip on the darkness."
"Yes, my lord," I said.
He smiled and adjusted my cloak. Already I could see his thoughts turning elsewhere. He would attend Cecily Laveau-Perrin's private midwinter masque, he and Alcuin. Thus did Delaunay advise me, and then there was no more time, for Melisande's coach arrived, and a livery servant in Charizai black and gold stood at the door, bowing. It was a new coach, a cunning little trap I'd not seen before, black trimmed in gold, with room only for two in the plush velvet seats. The door panels bore the insignia of House Charizai, three keys intertwined, nigh lost in the elaborate pattern. I knew the legend. Cushiel was said to have held the keys to the portals of hell. A matched team of four white horses drew the trap, beautiful creatures with arching necks picking up their hooves daintily on the flagstones. Jocelyn Verai was like a dire shadow, accompanying me to the coach. Twilight came early these short days, and a hoar-frost lay on the courtyard, making everything but the castelline sparkle under the evening stars. He helped me into the coach and sat beside me glowering, while the livery servant climbed into the driver's seat and snapped his whip. Bells jingled on the harness. "How would you pass this night were you not in Delaunay's service?" I ventured to ask him.
"Meditating," he said, "in the Temple of Elowa."
"Not Carsiel?"
"Carsiel does not have temples,"
Jocelyn replied shortly, and after that I made no further effort to engage him in conversation. We arrived at Melisande's home in short order. One thing I will say about her, she never failed to surprise. We were greeted not only by Melisande herself, but also by the captain of her modest guard, and four of his best men, and the guard bowed low as we were admitted, not to me, but to Jocelyn.
"Well met, Brother Carsiel,"
the Charizai captain said as he straightened, and there was nothing but sincerity in his handsome face and resonant voice.
"I am Michel Entrevaux, captain of the Charizai guard, and I am bid to make you welcome this longest night. Will you honour us with your company?"
It caught Jocelyn unprepared. I dare say he was ready for anything but respect in Melisande Charizai's home. He had quarrelled with Delaunay thrice this week about accompanying me on this assignation, since Delaunay was minded that Jocelyn remain here and not travel to the Duke de Morban's masque. We, who are well trained, react out of reflex, In Jocelyn's case, he responded with his cross, vam-braced bow.
"The honour would be mine," he replied formally.
Melisande Charizai, at once resplendent and demure in a long coat of black and gold brocade, her hair braided in a crown, smiled warmly.
"There is a niche in the garden, Messire Castelline, if you wish to maintain Eloa's vigil. Fedra, well met."
She stooped to kiss me in greeting, and the scent of her perfume surrounded me, but her kiss was no more than perfunctory, and left me able to stand. It made me more nervous than the other kind.
"Young men," Melisande murmured when they had left, smiling faintly, "such a sense of honour. Is he a little bit in love with you, do you think?"
"Jocelyn quite despises me," I said, "my lady."
"Oh, love and hate are two sides of the same blade," she said cheerily enough, motioning for a servant to take my cloak, "and an edge finer honed than yon Castelline's daggers divides them."
Her servants led the way to her receiving room, gliding silently ahead to open doors. She took my arm as we went.
"You despise your patrons a little, and you love them too, yes?"
"Yes, my lady." I sat down in the chair held for me and accepted a glass of joie, eyeing her warily. "A little."
"And how many of them do you fear?"
I held my glass without sipping, as she did, and answered honestly. "One at least, not at all. Most of them sometimes. You, my lady, always."
The blue of her eyes was like the sky at twilight when the first stars appear.
"Good."
Her smile held promises I shuddered to think on.
"Be at ease in it, Fedra. This is the longest night, and I am in no hurry. You're not like the others, who are trained to it from birth, like hounds cringing under the whip for a kind touch from their master's hand. No, you embrace the lash. But even so, there is aught in you that rebels at it. Let others plumb the depths of the former. 'Tis the latter that interests me."
At that I did shudder. "I am at my lady's command."
"Command?"
Melisande held her glass to the light, inspecting the sparkling cordial.
"Command is for captains and generals. I have no interest in command. If you would obey, you will discern what pleases me, and do it unasked."
She lifted her glass to me, smiling.
"Joy."
"Joy," I echoed it unthinkingly, and drank the joie. It burned, sweet and fiery, blazing a trail down my throat, evoking memories of the great hall at Sirius House, a blazing hearth, and the smell of evergreen boughs.
"Ah, you do please me, Fedra. You please me a great deal."
Rising, Melisande set down her empty glass and reached down to stroke my cheek.
"My attendants will make you ready. We'll leave for Quinsel de Morban's mosque in an hour's time."
With that she swept from the room, leaving only the lingering scent of her perfume, and a maidservant with downcast eyes came to lead me away. There was a hot bath awaiting, fresh drawn with wreaths of steam still curling above the surface of the water, candles set all around, and two more attendants waiting. I luxuriated in the bath, while one of Melisande's attendants rubbed fragrant oil into my skin, and another tended to my hair, brushing it out at length, merely twining a few sprays of white ribbons in my dark curls. When the maidservant brought in my costume, I rose from the bath, letting them wind a linen sheet about my damp body, and looked at what she had brought. I am used to fine clothing and not easily impressed, but the overgarment took even me aback. It was a loose-fitting gown of transparent white gauze with trailing sleeves, and it was spangled all about with tiny diamonds, sewn with exquisite care onto the sheer fabric.
"Name of Eloa! What does it go over?"
The maidservant fussed with a half-mask, a white and brown feathered osprey, with the eye-holes trimmed in black velvet piping.
"You, my lady," she said quietly.
In the candlelight I could see right through the gauze. I would be as good as naked in it, before half the nobles of Cushith.
"No!" Yes.
Her manner may have been meek, but no one in Melisande's service was going to gainsay their mistress.
And this,
she held out one other item, a velvet slip collar with a diamond teardrop suspended from it and a lead attached. I closed my eyes. I had seen such things in Valyrian House. In the privacy of the night court, it would not be so bad. But Melisande meant to display me before the peers of the realm. Gently and inexorably, her attendants helped me dress, putting on the sheer garment, adjusting my hair so that it spilled down my back, drawing the slip collar over my head, and settling it so the diamond fell just so in the hollow of my throat, and placing the mask on me. When they were done, I looked at myself in the long mirror. A captive creature gazed back, masked and collared, naked beneath a scintillating curtain of gauze.
"Very nice,"
Melisande's voice, amused, startled me. Like Jocelyn, I reacted out of reflex. A castellan bows in defense, and an adept of the night court kneels. I knelt and gazed up at her. As I was in sheerest white, she was in densest black, velvet skirts sweeping the floor, the bodice tight to her torso, white shoulders rising above it, and black gloves above the elbow. Her mask was black, night-black feathers with a dark rainbow sheen upon them, sweeping up in points to mingle with her elaborately styled hair. A band of black opals on velvet encircled her throat, like the colors that glimmer round a cormorant's neck, and I knew what her costume was then, and mine.